just look at the situation and see what the implications are, then they will, gee, we've got a problem.
Yeah.
But it's not obvious to the person in the street, because the physical system has these time constants. It doesn't respond immediately, but you're guaranteed that there will be responses, some of which you don't understand how rapidly they will occur, and that's a perfect example where it's not clear that the emissions at present are that close to a tipping point. But
that was Professor James Hansen speaking during an interview I recorded in Vienna at the European Geophysical Union Conference in 2012. In this Climate Gen episode, I speak with David Spratt, Research Director at the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration in Australia, about his recent article titled Reclaiming the Climate Emergency. The links to the article are in the notes. We discuss the origins, the treatment, and the what next aspect of how do we reclaim and respond appropriately in a real climate emergency, much like the one we are irrefutably in. I have also inserted a segment from this first interview with Professor Hansen in the interview with David to better highlight how perilous the lack of action over the last decade has really been. Patreon and YouTube Water Tier members can also watch the whole unedited 26 minutes interview with Professor Hansen that I've just uploaded. Given the lack of any progress on tackling climate change, much of what Jim said in 2012 is still entirely relevant today. Thank you for listening. I'm currently working on an interview and article with Professor Jingfang Fan at the University of Beijing and also Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. We discuss his research on teleconnections between Earth system tipping points and the identification of possible cascade mechanisms. Thank you. David, it's very good to see you again. Can we start by you giving us a background, just a brief overview on the term climate emergency, because that's kind of where we're going to focus on with this conversation.
Yes, I mean, it's a word that nobody heard about, then everybody heard about it, and then it got greenwashed and lost its meaning. So it's been through quite a trajectory. I mean, I got involved with Philip Sutton in 2007, writing a book called Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action, which I think was the first book that probably codified in some length the idea of what climate emergency was. Obviously, there had been work before that. Lester Brown had talked about the war mobilization analogy. So lots of people have been talking about the need to step up. But I think Code Red employed the words climate and emergency together as a meme for the first time. And that book basically said three things. The first was, the science is worse than policymakers understand. I mean, this is 2007. This is when nobody's talking about tipping points, when the IPCC was saying that Antarctica would be stable for 1,000 years, which seems incredible, where Greenland wouldn't melt until 2.5 degrees. So we said, the science is worse than policymakers understand. The second thing we talked about was the goal, because this was a period where everybody was talking about that odd phrase, preventing dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. That was all the talk at COPs, which was all about 2 degrees and 450 parts per million. And really following Jim Hansen, who'd said, no, what's safe is under 0.5 degree. What's safe is basically the Holocene range of temperatures, which Jim Hansen identified as under 325 parts per million of CO2. We said, no, 2 degrees is a really unsafe target. And what we should do is talk about a safe climate. And the third thing we did, we said, when you put those two things together, we've got to move much faster than policymakers think. This has got to be the first priority globally. It requires a social mobilization. It requires no trade-offs. It requires what Lester Brown said, a war level of mobilization. So that was sort of the genesis of the term from our point of view.
Okay, and what's really happened? Because that mobilization certainly hasn't happened. We seem to be seeing an acceleration of impacts, lower atmospheric concentrations, and yet the term climate emergency has been adopted everywhere and then sort of put into the top drawer. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a term that after some period of time got picked up by the climate mobilization in the United States, and allies of the climate mobilization actually got the term into Bernie Sanders' campaign, and he started talking about it in 2015-16, and that really helped to spread it. At the same time, people in various countries were trying to work up to the political system from local government level to national level. So there's a lot of campaign to get local government authorities and councillors to sign up to climate emergency. And that resulted in the first ever climate emergency declaration by a Melbourne council where I live in December 2016. You had the Greens in the UK were on a similar process of campaigning at a county and a local level, as were people in Canada. So it's this process in different parts of the world almost autonomously taking up this term. TCM, the Climate Mobilisation, then started talking to Roger Hallam in the early days of Extinction Rebellion, and he took up the phrase as one of his three key phrases. Obviously, Greta Thunberg and her movement did as well. So there's this really outpouring of engagement with the word climate emergency almost from nowhere, so that by 2019, the Oxford Dictionary had called it their word of the year. So it really exploded. But of course, with that explosion, the meaning got lost. I think it helped to say things are more urgent than we think. I think it's better to talk about climate emergency than climate change. And people like Greta really said, you know, the house is on fire. This is an emergency. So I think some of the message got through. But obviously, when government's saying this is a climate emergency and we're opening a new gas field, there's a great discontinuity.
Yeah, exactly. And if we go slightly behind the phrase, and we were talking about what the scientists are telling us and how that message or that research gets broken down as it gets put into a form that gets handed to policymakers. Can you talk a little bit about that transition, if you like?
Well, I mean, I think there's a great gap between the sort of things we hear out of the IPCC or the Conference of the Parties and what scientists are saying on the ground, because if you look at the Paris Agreement, if you look at the COP since, they're saying on net zero by 2050, we've got another 30 years to get to zero. Last week, I saw some figures from the US Energy Administration projecting that carbon dioxide emissions from energy production in the US in 2050 will be 80% of what they are today. So there's this incredible discontinuity between what's going on and what is said. I think at the policymaking level, there has been a downplaying of the risk. We know in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of more understanding about the Earth as a system, these tipping points with large system elements, whether they're ice sheets or permafrost or circulatory systems can change rapidly, what they call tip and interact and cascade, which is basically excluded from the IPCC reports. And I think the thing that's really struck me as the problem is that if you look at the IPCC reports, the latest summary for policymakers, which has just come out, and they say, we've got a carbon budget. And this is a carbon budget with the 50% or 66% chance of success. What they should say is a 50% or a 33% chance of failure. That is, here's the amount of carbon we can emit and keep warming to 2 degrees. But by the way, there's a 1 in 2 chance we could get to more than 2 degrees. And in fact, a carbon budget with a 50% chance of exceeding 2 degrees has a 10% chance of 4 degrees, which is the end of human civilization. And it just strikes me as absurd that in this framing of the science at the IPCC level, we're accepting risks of failure that we don't accept in our own lives. We wouldn't put a child in the car seat. We wouldn't get on a bridge. We wouldn't get on a plane if there was more than a fraction of a 1% chance of failure. But here, at the middle of the science, they're communicating, they're saying, here's a third of a chance that civilization's going to end. Sign up to this carbon budget. And the fact is that if you have a low risk of not exceeding the target, there are no carbon budgets left. Carbon budgets are an artificial construction of a catastrophic engagement with risk. So I think that's really core problem, that the risks are not being seriously understood and then put into the policy options. Because the policy option was, we should have been at zero yesterday. That's the real science.
Looking back now, I remember, I think it was 11 years ago, I was interviewing James Hansen in Vienna, and he said,
we're going to need to reduce fossil fuel emissions by about 5 or 6% per year if we begin within the next year or two. If we wait 10 years to begin to reduce the emissions, then we'll have to reduce them 15% a year to achieve climate stabilization this century. And that is impractical. That's why it's really important that we begin to have policies that cause a reduction in emissions.
And here we are, sure enough, 10 years, 11 years later, emissions still rising, and we desperately need structural changes. In the article you've written recently, you've emphasized quite heavily the importance of state leadership, and whether it's at the national level, but also the international level. Can you talk a bit about why it's so critical in the context of what we've currently got?
Well, I mean, the big choice is, which is the current policymaking paradigm, is basically that markets will solve the problem. If we think about, you know, how the Paris Agreement is structured, or for example, the last Working Group 3 report from the IPCC on what to do used the word cost-effectiveness 173 times. It's all about, oh, the market is effective, the market is consistent, the market will do it. And that's why all the discussion is about carbon taxes, prices, carbon offsets, which are really a new form of commodity, carbon capture and storage, which is creating a huge new market for oil and gas industry to fill the holes from which the fossil fuel has come with CO2, which has been liquefied. So it's all about market solutions. And the fact is that those solutions haven't worked. I mean, the last 30 years has been a preoccupation with market solutions, and they failed. And the question is why? I think there are two reasons. You know, there's been an understanding that we're now looking at what people call existential risk, which is not a risk that humans going extinct, but of social breakdown nationally and globally of a large order. So that the system breaks down, collapse, whatever you want to call it. And the thing that risk experts say to me is, when risks are existential or really high, you've got to look at the worst case scenario. I mean, that's what we do with probably nuclear weapons. We say, what's the worst thing could happen? Somebody might drop it on somebody else. So all the work's got to be on stopping that event happen. So the risks are really high. The damages of climate change are now so high. You can't put a figure on what's happened in Syria. You can't put a figure on a Pacific island drowning so people aren't there. This is beyond quantification. You know, you can't put numbers on it. And all the models and all the economic thinking about climate change says, here is a model, we can plug in numbers and the model will efficiently produce a price on carbon and solve the problem. As soon as you put in a number called infinite, the model breaks down, the algorithm doesn't work at all. So I think there's a problem with trying to quantify things which can no longer be quantified. And I think the other thing is, if you look at the crisis we face, I mean, whether there's a banking crisis, we've got another one now. As soon as the financial market fails, the state intervenes really quickly, really dramatically, and will shut down markets, close markets. The same is true of pandemics. I mean, we've just been through 2 years where the market was severely curtailed by governments in order for humanity, by and large, to survive. It's the same with natural disasters, fire, floods. The government comes in and says, we've got the key role in trying to get this disaster response under control. We'll oversee the immediate response, then we will oversee the transition. And in all those cases, markets fail because they can't assess the risk. And obviously, climate change is a bigger risk than a pandemic or a war. Honestly, I think we all know that now. It's not quantifiable. And I guess, the second part of the argument is that for anybody who's done any economics, there are these things called externalities that, you know, you can have a market, but if a byproduct of a production system is something which is going to poison somebody but is not included in the price, then you've got this external cost associated with the market transaction and the government's got to intervene. So they say, well, we'll put a price on the pollution to make this good more expensive so people will buy less of it. I mean, the problem is now that we need to put a price on fossil fuels so nobody buys any of them. And so it's no longer a question of saying, can we price the externality? What we now have to do is ban the externality. I mean, government has got to intervene decisively to take fossil fuels out of the market. You can't nudge the price of petrol up so people stop using it. That's not the way it works. So because markets crave stability and hate disruption, they're just not well set up to deal with the disruption that climate change is going to produce. I mean, there was a report recently in the US looking at real estate properties near the water, and they said there was $173 billion worth of real estate that would be kaput. That's not in the market. The market can't deal with those sort of damages. It's just beyond the market system.
Okay. And when you talk about these sorts of industries as well, that are all part of the market, and you look at the guys who are running these corporations, you use a term in the article, executive myopia. they can't see or respond to these events, as you're saying. That implies that we've got a lock-in of systemic destruction in a way. Is that how you would frame it?
Funnily enough, given the sort of things I say, I mean, some people have sought me out to have conversations who run multi-billion dollar investment firms. And I mean, there's a range of those people who really actually get it. They know what's going on. I mean, they're financial analysts. I mean, there's a guy who I really love in the US. I don't know whether you've ever interviewed him, called Spencer Glendon, who was at the Woodwell Center. And he says, it's not a market optimization problem. It's a risk problem. And the risk is the loss of capitalism. And I think within big capital, there are people who get that that's what's coming up. I mean, they'll talk to you about their children and their grandchildren. They'll want a safe place to go. And you have to tell them there are no safe places in a hot climate. So I think, you know, the elite are not stupid. And they spend a lot of money on management consultants to avoid losing all their money. And they're being told this sort of stuff. I think the problem is they then, because this is what they're good at, they're going to go back and think about how the market can solve the problem, rather than saying the market can't solve the problem, only political leadership, only the state. It's, you know, like being a business leader in 1939 in Europe watching, or in America watching the war coming and going, how can the market, you know, stop Hitler? You can't. It requires state leadership to deal with the threat. And so I think a lot of business people, elites around the world get it, but they keep on because this is the group thing. This is the executive myopia, their inability to think the unthinkable, because their whole world is the market can price risk and solve everything and prices are efficient. That's what they come back to. And I think that's the group think.
Okay. The next question I wanted to ask was really, what would be the intervention at the state level, political level, do you think that would now orientate us in the right direction?
Look, I mean, I think the big challenge is we now live in a globalized world, and we've seen that with the war in Ukraine, that something in one part of the world has echoed around the world with supply chain disruptions and disruptions to the global food supply that have echoed everywhere. So in a sense, it's very hard for an individual nation, an individual state, to pull all the levers because it's so connected to the rest of the world. So I think you need, you know, a number of players to move in unison. I mean, in an ideal world, I mean, even if the EU and China were to come to a deal and do something, they could really drive change because they're politically powerful enough to do so. And I think you've got to give the Churchill speech. You've got to do what, you know, Zelensky said, what people have done, you know, what Kennedy said in a different era about civil rights. We are about to hit the wall. We are going to have to do things very differently. The things we've talked about and the way this society is running is not going to be the way it has to be for the next period if we're going to be here. I mean, it has to be a certain amount of shock and awe. And I think people are ready for that. I mean, if you look at Greta, if you look at the number of people who are involved in direct action, putting their bodies on the line, people are desperate. I mean, people are psychologically suffering because they know what's coming up. And I think that's the sort of approach. I mean, just, as Greta says, just a little bit of political honesty from political leaders. We hear it. We hear it from the UN Secretary General. He's really brutal, but then he's not an elected prime minister and he's a little bit to one side. But you don't hear many political leaders except the really small, most vulnerable nations, the Pacific leaders. You don't hear many others just calling a spade a spade.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see Antonio Guterres make these kinds of statements, which make him look a little bit politically isolated, because he's saying literally what needs to be said. And the world is just spinning around him in its own trauma. But we started off, and your article is about reclaiming climate emergency. And from where we are now, if you were to reclaim it, and I think that there is a big reclaiming of it, especially going on with activists around the world in places like Africa, been really impressive articulation of their issues, and Bangladesh and so on and so forth. If we were going to reclaim it now in places like the UK or US, what do you think reclaiming it looks like?
Well, funnily enough, I come back to XR a little bit. Risk managers say when risks are really high, and this is something the military takes up and other people take up, when risks are really high and threats are really high, the first thing you've got to do is be brutally honest. I mean, this is maybe some of the problems that the Russians have had in Ukraine, that they believe things about the capacity of their own military that weren't true. And it caused, it caused a big problem. When risks are really high, you've got to be brutally honest about the reality. And I think that's the starting point. I think the 3XR demands to start with was climate emergency, tell the truth in people's assemblies. I mean, we actually haven't got to the telling the truth stage yet. Guterres has, but the IPCC, the COPs, are delusional and untruth telling.
Okay, so that's first base.
That's first base. And from there, I think the other thing is that when we wrote Climate Code Red, we talked about the difference between normal mode and emergency mode. I mean, you think about it. I mean, if there's a flood or a tornado or whatever, several things happen. First of all is you tend to have less partisan politics because the government, the opposition, whoever, all say, okay, we've got to devote a lot of resources to do this. The second thing is you don't get so much arguing about whether we've got enough money, because people being flooded, you've got to send in enough boats to get them out. The third thing is that you defer or put to one side the normal functioning of the society until you've resolved the problem. I mean, I remember I was brought up in places where it flood and you'd be at school and at 11 o'clock in the morning, the bell would ring and everybody say, pick up your bags, go home, or jump, get on the bus to go back up the river, because if you don't, the bridge will be flooded. So all sorts of normal functionings of society are actually closed down or disrupted, even in the pandemic, because that's necessary. I guess the other thing is that in emergencies, there isn't that sense of political compromise. What strikes me about the policymaking process is that policymakers at COPs and so on think they can negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. Oh, yes, we should do X, but we're going to do one third of X because that's the deal and we're diplomats and we deal all the time. I mean, in an emergency, you actually say, we've got to do what we've got to do. I mean, this is the idea we're trying to get across with climate emergencies, that emergency mode is mentally the other side to the normal operations of society. It's the no compromise. It's the partisanship. It's making it the highest priority of the society, devoting the resources that are necessary. So it's a different social political mode as much as anything else.
That's been very insightful. So thank you very much. I've enjoyed discussing that.
Thank you, Nick.